I mean, famously not a particularly nice guy, I think.
No, not.
Who is this?
Volpe.
Volpe, he's not a nice guy.
No.
Okay, good. We'll air this on the radio. Who else don't you like? I'd like to start with a little aperitif.
Maybe I should just go right into my family.
Oh. Something I can laud over you at future times.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Do you want to track mark this, Phil, or are you just going to let it...
Yeah, we just let it roll.
Oh, you want to torment me, don't you? You're not there when I'm editing.
Okay. Oh, you edit yourself?
Huh, I do.
You're a hard worker.
Yes, I am, sir.
But that makes for a better show.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it does. Yep. Yes, it does. And you will hear it once you get aired. Okay, so we shall begin, Edgar.
Excellent.
Meyer. You are a double bass virtuoso. Can you tell us what a double bass virtuoso is?
Well, I just play the bass. You know, I play the upright bass. You call it acoustic bass, double bass, string bass. Looks a little bit like a big violin. But that's how I spend a lot of my time. And I guess a little bit unconventional in using the instrument a lot as a melody instrument in addition to collaborating with a lot of people. I think traditionally the instrument's thought of as the backbone of the music and the kind of the underpinning, but it's also an interesting instrument to actually expose and to actually hear what it can do. So that's part of my life.
So the instrument that you use to play classical and bluegrass is the same instrument that we hear in jazz music, essentially. You're just using it with different musicianship.
I think that's right.
Okay, it's the same physical instrument.
Yes, it is.
Okay, with a different man behind it creating a different sound.
Yes.
When you say creating more melody behind it, do you... I'm going right off my questions immediately.
Yeah.
But do you derive your work from Ray Brown or other jazz musicians at all? Who are your primary influences?
Well, you know, a question like that, I get in a lot of trouble very fast because I would certainly be able to list 500 primary influences. And having had 25 years to kind of sort this out, I have decided that, you know, my primary influence actually is J.S. Bach, and my other big ones for me are Beethoven and Mozart. Of bass players, first of all, I would say that bass players are probably not the biggest influence on what I do, but of bass players, no one influenced me more than Ray Brown did. And once again, Ray Brown is somebody who's somehow maybe more than a bass player. You know, he had a point of view about music and knew a lot about it, and that probably was part of his influence on me. But you can't deny the way of playing and the voice that he had either.
What kind of a bass instrument do you play? Does it have a year that it was born and a place that it was created?
Bass that I primarily play was made in 1769 in Florence, Italy, by Johanna Baptista Gabrielli, and it's a bass that my father fell in love with around 1958. I was born in 60, and this bass, I think my father coveted this instrument for many years, and he knew the man who owned it after a certain point, George Hofer in Savannah, Georgia, who was a school teacher like my father, taught orchestra, and they stayed in good touch, and in 1983, when I was 23, George called my father and said he was ready to sell it. So I've played the bass since 1983.
He sold it to your father or to you?
Actually, to me at that point, because my father wanted me to have it at that point because I was 23, and he thought that it was the thing I needed professionally was to have a great instrument like that.
But your dad was, in fact, a bass player as
yes,
well.
Yes, that's
that right?
Right. Yes.
Were there other musical influences on you in your family? Do you come from a musical lineage?
Well, none that add up to what my father contributed. My father loved music in kind of an unbelievable way, and certainly a lot of reverence for it, also just a lot of sheer pleasure, and that was simply the environment that I grew up in, and so that seemed like a direct pass. I mean, music was something that was completely central to me since I can remember. And that, you know, coincidentally, there were things like, you know, one of my mother's brothers played bass, one of my father's brothers played bass. So there was stuff laying around that was unusual in the degree of coincidence, but the big influence was my father.
You were surrounded by three members of your family that played the bass, though. I can't let that go by. That's extraordinary. Don't you find that extraordinary?
Well, you know, a lot of them worked on a farm, too, but I mean, it doesn't seem extraordinary to me.
I understand that,
yeah.
But you can acknowledge that would be a little unusual.
I acknowledge it.
Okay, thank yes. you. Were you exposed to a variety of genres of music growing up? What was playing in your house when you were growing up?
Primarily jazz and classical. And I guess there was some balance. You know, my mother was not a musician, and so there were things that she and my father could both enjoy, different singers like Nina Simone or folks like that. But there would be the primary thing was instrumental music with jazz and classical. My father had grown up playing jazz, and then he later in life learned to read music and use a bow, and he also just remembered his mother playing classical music on the piano before she died, and that was when he was 8. So he had some kind of, it had a extreme significance for him, and so he but basically jazz and classical music, especially on Sunday mornings. I would hear a lot of violin concertos, Beethoven and Bach and Brahms, and often with Heifetz and Oistrakh were preferred, it seemed, by my father. And then, you know, kind of the regular canon of jazz recordings from the early 60s. And that was certainly the... and parts of it I didn't realize that were so entrenched in my background. I remember going out to hear Mingus Big Band, and then they were playing some of the old Mingus records in the breaks. And I hadn't heard any of that music for 20 years, or not a lot of it. And I realized that I had incorporated a lot of those ideas and decided they were my own ideas. And having been 20 years since I'd heard them, I didn't realize, you know, sometimes you have to take a while to figure out where you got stuff.
That's really interesting. The Mingus Big Band that plays at Iridium
right,
every yeah. Monday?
Is it I don't
Monday
know.
Or Tuesday. I get spammed by them, and I know that they're there. You live in Nashville? Currently?
I live in Nashville.
Is that where you grew up?
I grew up in East Tennessee. Nashville's nice. East Tennessee is beautiful. My father grew up in Chattanooga. I just played with the orchestra in Chattanooga a month ago, and we had 70 fairly near relatives show up.
70 relatives?
Yes.
Were they all hooting?
yeah.
Edgar!
It wasn't too tough. But it was nice to see everybody. My father, Chattanooga has all these ridges, and it's really beautiful. And I grew up in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is very similar. It's more mountainous. It's not like foothills. I mean, it's a lot of these ridges that come across, and it's evocative. It's a pleasant place to grow up.
And did you live on a farm when you were growing up? But some of your relatives were farmers.
My father grew up on a farm.
Okay.
And it just, you know, we went to visit my grandfather when I was young, and you know, he had a couple of farms until he died. He was 96 when he died, I believe.
Wow.
So, he lived kind of an interesting lifestyle. I remember my grandfather would, he would not keep cash, and he would not keep a bank account, but he had like 500 acres. And so he would, you know, mark trees to pay taxes, and he'd go to the grocery store, and I remember him spending $1.44.
If you remembered, it must have been about, what, 1967?
Yeah, you're right, Sorry. You got the right idea.
Yes.
But it was remarkable. He'd get salt and pepper and maybe a little bit, I don't know, maybe some cereal, I think.
Wow. Now, when you have recorded, how many albums now? Do you know?
I don't know.
You don't?
I can guess that under my own, well, probably played on several hundred, most of those earlier on, and then probably of situations where it's either a record where I'm a designated leader or where there's one or two or three designated leaders, probably a total of, I'm going to say 12 to 15.
12 to 15, where your name is emblazoned on the
Well, cover. Where I'm responsible for whatever happened.
Ah, okay.
Better,
well,
for better or for worse.
I like that answer. That actually takes the ego out of it and puts the responsibility back into the artistic process. Yeah. So how do you... Let me backtrack here. You've been described as having one foot in the world of classical and one foot in bluegrass. And I'd like to get from you. I'm personally opposed to pigeonholing musicians at all.
Right.
And I'd like to know how you would describe your musical interests. Start again. I'd like to know how you would describe your musical interests and your work.
Well, boy, you would think 20 years later I'd be able to. I don't have an immediate answer. When I think about it, the first thing I think about is the communities of people that I'm involved with. And it feels like a couple of extended families, you know, just very good friends that play classical music and are very involved in that, and very good friends that play bluegrass instruments and are instrumentalists. And so, you know, and really one of my favorite aspects of the whole thing, maybe my favorite aspect, is this feeling of community or a sense of kind of involvement in these big families.
Didn't you become involved with these big families because of your interest in that genre? Or rather, did you meet the musicians and then go and
I would say in the case of the bluegrass instrumentalist, a large portion of the interest was purely the individuals, I have to say. I mean, it was threefold in that I think that having grown up around jazz, there were some aspects of it that were difficult for me. And they were not things that are fundamental to the music. They're details. But the way the bass interacts sonically with the drums and the piano defines the bass's role very immediately. And it was not a role that that I wanted to spend my life in. My own, you know, part of it just wanting to have a more vocal role with the bow and also wanting to have a different type of dialogue with the other instruments. That I found that when I would sit down with a mandolin or a guitar or a banjo, that the dynamically we were very equal. We could play soft together. We could play loud together. Drums and piano play loud together. I don't even need to be there. And it don't matter who you are on bass. And all you can do is amplify it and turn it up. And so I just didn't want to live my whole life that way. And so it was important to me to hit this pocket of instruments where I felt like the dialogue was much more achievable. And then secondarily, I really do love old-time and bluegrass music and had just a big attraction for it from my teenage years on. And thirdly, the individuals. The talent pool was fantastic at that point in my life with people like Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas and Mark O'Connor and Bela Fleck, and that was like where I wanted to be.
Would you hit the space bar for a second, Phil, so we can have a water break? Always ready.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're rolling. Getting back to the subject of pigeonholing artists, you've also been called a crossover artist. What does that term mean to you, and do you relate to it?
I don't really relate to it. Technically, just in terms of what it's trying to specifically say, I feel like I've probably not really migrating from place to place. I'm not starting in one place and ending up in another. I guess, you know, I skip that answer. I'll go straight to the point.
We can edit you, Edgar.
Yes,
it's okay.
The term has enough history that the baggage is inescapable. And the worst of that history really involves extremely famous people trying to expand their audience with music that they're not so good at. So given that particular history, it's not a word that I'm just jumping up and down to be associated with.
Okay, fair enough. Are you deliberately working to break down some of the barriers in the music industry?
No, I mean, I've actually never felt like there were barriers.
That's interesting.
I realized
that there was a pigeonholing of this person is a jazz artist, this person is a pop artist, this person is a classical artist.
I see it, but I've never felt like it. I've never felt limited personally by it.
Okay, that's a wonderful perspective. You're the senior publicity director at Sony. I asked her to describe the CD, your new CD, self-titled Edgar Meyer, and she said, "It's Edgar. It's just Edgar."
I feel like I've had the opportunity to be myself, and they may not be able to plug me into a VH1 niche, but the opportunities I've had, I think, are extraordinary. And so I don't see how I could complain and say that I'd been limited.
Well, you consider yourself fortunate in that way, or do you
yes,
think
Yes, I do. Very much.
And you compose as well as play music. Do you consider yourself prolific as a composer?
No.
What's your artistic process like?
Wait until I'm really behind and then get started.
It's the procrastinate and then work until 3 a.m. technique?
Just work as hard as I can and be, you know, live an unpleasant life for long periods.
Do you really do that consistently? You've
yes,
noticed
I do.
That. That's what you do.
Over 20 years, yes.
That's amazing to me. For instance, Paul Simon has said that he wakes up every morning and puts himself at his desk and does it. Every artist is different. And even after 20 years of being a professional musician, you still do that to yourself. And do you think that that actually enhances your...
No.
No. Okay, so it's a time management thing.
You want to ask me why I don't change it? I don't know why I don't change it.
Okay. Okay. So you are not... Do you flagellate yourself for doing it over and over again? Certainly, I would if I were in a similar position. I'm just wondering.
Maybe
do you
I should because
that?
I don't flagellate myself over it.
Oh, that's so interesting. I really do find that fascinating. So, if you have a deadline, you know that you do this. Did you do that when you were in elementary school as well? You writing
possibly
papers?
To some degree, possibly. And I was never, you know, in school, not very result oriented. I did very well, but. I probably got away with a lot.
But let me just backtrack a little bit. You stated, I think, that you think it diminishes the quality of your work, the fact that you put yourself into that position repeatedly. And
that is my biggest regret about it. And so I am trying harder and harder to do better because I do believe it diminishes the quality of the work.
That's fascinating. Thank you for sharing that.
I'm working hard at trying to be more consistent in my work efforts. And, you know, I'm doing a little better, but it's hard to evaluate because I've been in damage control for at least 4 or 5 months right now, being behind on things.
What things? Anything you can tell us about?
I've been behind on everything. I turned in a piece for Josh Bell to play off piano, you know, several months late. So it's on next year's tour instead of this year's tour. I am kind of squeaked through... a concerto that I was kind of re-premiering or rewritten out in Los Angeles with Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to organize this workshop for professional training workshop at Carnegie, and it should have been done weeks ago, and you know, have it right here.
Oh, you brought it with you in case you had downtime here at Full House Productions. I love that.
I have a piece that Bela Fleck and Zakir Hussain and myself are writing for a opening of a hall in September. And, you know, we're not going to have the entire piece ready for a reading in June, but it's just whatever I can get done. So that's what's going on.
I know that there are going to be many, many people listening to this broadcast that will be pleased to know that they're not alone in doing that. Right?
Yes.
We sort of put people who have notoriety on a pedestal in certain ways. So it's just nice to know that one can accomplish a great deal and still be working on their life process and organization and
mine needs aspire. Work.
Now, speaking of Joshua Bell and Bella Fleck, you've collaborated on projects with a whole host of and range of extraordinary musicians, including those guys and Yo-Yo Ma. But on your latest album, you are collaborating with just yourself.
Yes.
So in that same vein, how did you get along with yourself?
Extremely well.
Did you really?
I loved it.
You found yourself genial company.
I think that I really do want to spend the rest of my life in a very balanced way of working with other people and being alone.
Mm-hmm.
I get tremendous amounts from both.
Can you elaborate a little bit more about that? Actually, before we came on mic, I would like to repeat this because I thought it was interesting that the electronic press kit that was given to me showed your studio, your workspace, which is a wondrous, beautiful space with lots of windows. Mm. And to me, it looked, as a singer who hangs out with a lot of musicians, it looked like musician fantasy land because you had wondrous instruments and you were able to record by yourself and you had the space. And so tell me about what that's like. That must be...
It's about, as you say, it's musician fantasy land. Means I can, you know, get up at 3 a.m. and go play the piano and just be happy to be in there. Also, it's nice. It's well lit. A couple walls are primarily windows, and so I find that affects my attitude tremendously. There's never a time where I don't gravitate toward being in the room and just want to spend time there. And I think it's something I'd wanted all my life. I'd really, more than anything, all my life wanted a great piano, which is the centerpiece of the room.
What kind of piano is it?
It's a 1999 Homburg Steinway. It's a D. And it's a beautiful instrument. I looked for years and tried out a lot and have a lot of great pianist friends who helped me look and settled on this just about 3 years ago or so. Spending time in there is... I'll repeat. It's a fantasy.
Did you design that space in order to work and record in there?
Yes. I really shouldn't say I designed it. I knew I wanted a space like that, and I got wonderful help. My friend Dave Cinco consulted with the architects. Manuel Zeitlin was the primary architect, and he had done other work on the house before, and we knew he was wonderful. And we've seen a lot of other work of his, and so there was a lot of planning from every angle, just, you know, in terms of how it would fit into our lives and also how it would sound.
Now, you were talking about the 1999 Homburg Steinway that you have in the room, but we thought you were a double bass player. So how did you come to play the piano as well on this CD?
Well, piano I've played all my life, and, I guess not quite as long as the bass. I started the bass at age 5, and then the piano, we didn't have a piano in the house until I was probably 8 or 9, and I don't even remember precisely, but I'm guessing that that's when it was. And I still remember very vividly that the most exciting thing that I could even imagine was to play the piano, the idea of being able to play more than one line at once, I was just overwhelmed with how could you possibly do that, and I just wanted to know how to do that, and or to play chords or things like that. So, and my fascination of the instrument really never faded, and so I play piano a couple hours a day, most days, if I'm able.
And that story came up, excuse me, that piano came into your life in a kind of special way that you talk about in the liner notes of your new album.
Well, the particular piano that came into the house was my grandmother's piano.
Uh-huh.
And it was, you know, my father had very strong feelings for it since he had seen his mother play it, and he had lost his mother when he was 8. So that was a very big deal for him to have the piano in the house. And also I remember some of the first songs I played were Mendelssohn songs without words, and they're from her old books, which must have been from, I imagine they had to have been, you know, probably from the 1920s or so.
Do you still have any of that music?
You bet. You bet.
Is it in your studio?
Yes.
Someplace you can see, I would guess.
Oh, yeah.
What other instruments do you play on your new album? Self-titled Edgar Meyer.
In highly varying degrees of competence, banjo, dobro, guitar, mandolin, and treble viol, or viola da gamba, or gamba, that was built by Dan Hatchis. Beautiful little instrument. He's building me a set of 3, and that's the first.
Can you back up? Most of those instruments were familiar to many people, but what is a viola da gamba?
Well, I'm not even sure how you say which about it. I mean, I hear it called a gamba. I hear it called a treble viol. Maybe a viola da gamba also. But it's a instrument that's a violin size. But the gambas are the precursors of the violin and the cello. They in Bach's time, they were actually considered a more elegant instrument than the violin, which was considered kind of loud and screechy.
No kidding. It's the same size as a violin? I thought it was larger.
Well, the treble viol is violin-like in its size, but it looks like a little bass. It's shaped like a bass because the bass is a gamba. It's actually of that family and not of the violin and cello family. And gambas have frets and usually 6 strings. They tend to be all gut strings, and they're all forced with a third in the middle, so not totally unlike a guitar. Possibly, I don't know if there's any relationship between gamba and lute tuning. There might be, or it's also just easy to see how you could stumble on a 6-string tuning if you wanted to have octaves on the outside, you know, where you'd have to have 1/3 somewhere in the middle.
Huh. And you mentioned that you had varying degrees of competence on these instruments that you just listed. What kind of challenges did that present for you? Because you were recording for Sony Classical. It wasn't just something that was for yourself.
Well, the interesting thing is that they all presented exactly the same degree of challenge because if I could play the piano a little better than I can play the guitar, I'd write a harder piano part. You know, and so I would try to play up to my ability on each instrument. So the challenge was exactly equal in each case. And it also, the most pleasant part of this process, no, not the most, one of many pleasant aspects of this process, is simply that if something didn't sound good, I could do it again, or I could change instruments, or just take that section out. Or
you could just delete it and
throw
it on the virtual cutting room floor.
Yes, so it was never oh my God, that's, you know, one of my favorite moments on the record actually came in Please Don't Feed the Bear, which is an ABCBA song. It's a 5-section song, and the 4th of those sections, I had a melody that I was playing on the mandolin, and then I had a counterpoint to it that I was playing on the gamba, and I practiced for several days learning those 2 parts, and I finished recording it and worked very hard and edited it, and it sounded awful. And it was really above my abilities to play those parts. So I went back and recorded each instrument 1 note at a time, playing that same music. And on a longer note, I would actually have soft mandolin notes following it, so it kind of kept a little ping, 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 and I'd have all the tracks kind of, and I'd let all the notes ring, so it ended up that the mandolin notes end up sounding like a hammer dulcimer by doing it that way, and the gamba tracks, doing them that way, ended up sounding like I'm not sure what, but it was a much more interesting sound, and it was something that I stumbled on, you know, primarily, originally out of pure incompetence.
So the digital technology is merged with the musicianship.
Oh, all over the place. Very happily. But at the same time, you know, I try to draw on things that are the opposite of the digital technology. I mean, having played with great musicians for 20 years, I try to evoke a lot of the of what it is of people playing together. And I always, like, one of the a great suggestion that was made by my friend Bela Fleck early on was to not use click tracks for basic tracks. And I didn't. And it made a tremendous difference. So there's always this feeling of people listening to each other and never just like a really kind of ramrod, perfect straight time.
Can you explain to those who are not recording professionals
yeah.
what a click track is?
Well, a lot of commercial music is recorded with a beat in the headphones. Just, you know, it might even be just as simple as, usually is as simple as some, maybe a hi-hat just. And that way, if people are rushing or dragging, you know, they don't actually have to work as hard to play together. And they don't listen in the same way. You can get a more perfect, sometimes in some ways you can get a very perfect rhythm, but it usually kills some of the life of the beat in most cases. And in my case, you know, I'm not a super aggressive rhythmic kind of player in every way, but there's also other types of aspects that are killed by the click, which is just a kind of a give and take, just a back and forth. And so, you know, I just would always set up basic tracks without the click, and it also forces a person to kind of really determine the shape of the song and really work on that. Whereas with the click, you're a little less conscious of that, which is not a good thing.
Being by yourself in a room, I'm guessing you were able to be fully yourself and not altered at all by anybody else in the room. But was there a time, or you can contradict me if I'm wrong there, but yeah. was there, I'm just wondering if there was a time or if there came times when you missed the energy, performance energy and camaraderie of having other musicians to work with and bounce off of.
I didn't miss it. Of course, the wonder of playing with other people is maybe even primarily the things that happen that you don't expect. The energy of it happens and the reactions. But this was a different kind of project and was not trying to achieve that. What was interesting to me, I realized the first or second day I was working on it that I had never been alone in a room before recording. There's always an engineer.
Oh, wow. Yep.
And I had gravitated towards some wonderful engineers who knew how to either be present or not be present. But still, it was still, you know, not to have another body in the room was a new thing.
Yeah, I'll bet. Were you able to be more yourself, since I don't want to put words into
I found that over the course of it, I would say that I'm probably myself most of the time.
Okay.
And that it didn't change because I was alone. But that, but it was nice to find out what it was like to be alone, because you always wonder, because there's always all these pressures with other people around to do certain things, to do them on certain schedules, and you know, it was nice to find out what it would be like if in a perfect world. And it was fine. It was, you know, in many ways, it was an experience that cannot be paralleled another way. I mean, there's no way to get that feeling with other folks around.
Mm-hmm. Can we assume that somewhere in your future there will be another album of just you alone?
It's a pretty safe assumption, or something that, you know, that relates in some way where I get to spend a lot of time alone.
Are there any other projects on the horizon that we should be looking for out there? Things, you either collaborations or other projects you want us to know about?
Not at this moment. This is front and center for me right now.
That's fair enough.
This is, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, probably the next dropping off point is this hall opening in the fall with Bela Fleck and Zakir Hussain and myself. We're working with the Nashville Symphony for a new hall. They're opening. It's called Skirmhorn Symphony Center, and Leonard Slatkin's going to come conduct a piece that Bela and Zakir and myself will write and play with the orchestra.
That sounds fabulous.
It's wonderful. We've been Bela and Zakir and I have been getting together for a year now, and it's been a real high point.
That's in Nashville?
Yes.
What month?
September.
September of 2006?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have a life philosophy, some part of you that guides your work and your life?
Should I?
It's a question that I ask every interviewee because I think it's an interesting way to get to the heart of somebody's belief system, either as an artist or as a human being. What do you know for sure? Where do you come from? What motivates you?
I wouldn't be able to give a complete answer on that one.
Okay.
I don't have a philosophy per se. I certainly would have to unravel a lot of pieces that would take more time. It would take you 3 or 4 complete shows.
Okay. We could look forward to that, Edgar.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You could interview yourself like you did for iTunes. I think that's a wrap. Is there anything that I didn't touch on that you had in mind, Susan, or that you had in mind, Edgar, that...
Well, you know, one thing, I guess there's... I should give it a little thought to the philosophy question, but it's a little bit...
It's not my intent to flummox you. It's just...
No, I know that.
Direction that... I mean, that's just...
You just manage to do it all the time.
Yeah. Speaking of having engineers in the room and how irksome they can be...
What kind of answers do you get?
They run the gamut, honestly. I'm really looking for the driving belief systems of people who are extraordinary in life and sharing that with people who are living more, ordinary is the wrong word, but living lives that are less in the public eye or less of less notoriety to give them.
Oh, it's a great question. And I don't, I think that since I don't have a lot of that organized, I'm avoiding it. Well, I actually answered it directly. I mean, I'd have to unravel some shit.
Or some stuff, since this is the world of the evil FCC. Okay, unravel some stuff.
There's one other thing that I often like to talk about, which seems like it might go somewhere, but it might not. And I had the chance to do it, and I just somehow didn't quite get there. I think you got it, though. I mean, sometimes I get into talking about the process a little bit, just that, you know, that doing this type of record allows a different type of interaction between all the different processes of writing and recording and playing and all these things. And things can be done in different orders and in a patchwork. And also they can affect each other a little more than they would otherwise.
I think we did actually touch upon that, but that's seems like it would be very freeing to be able to. It's almost like making a film, right? Where you're.
It's much more like that, and that's part of my attraction to this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That, in comparison, most collaborative processes are defined kind of in the moment, and this is more like writing a novel or doing a sculpture or doing a film, and so that. The playing can drive it at some points. Writing can be approached from many different angles. It can be a completely worked out piece of music, or I can start with nothing. In one case, there was a piece that I improvised at the piano for 9 minutes, and it was just the first take, and I kept it and added instruments. Mm-hmm. And in other cases, I would, you know, record some music and then see where it wanted to go. And then write some music, you know, in reaction to that. So all different speeds of writing and reacting, and also just, mixing the processes up too. Being able to sit down and practice a piano part for a couple weeks, and then record it in a couple of mornings and edit it, instead of recording all the music and then editing all the music. It's much more integrated and. In some ways, certain ways, it can be a more effective process.
Did you find that you would overthink, though, sometimes, or overanalyze after the fact?
I don't really know how to answer the question about overthinking and overanalyzing because I know I can overshoot sometimes on that, you know, and get rid of something that was good. But of course, obviously, with all these programs, usually you can usually get back to wherever you were if you liked it.
Right.
But you know, a student asked me the other day, "How do you know when it's good enough?" And I didn't have an answer because that's not really my approach.
Well, then, what is your approach?
Well, just trying to make the best thing that I can, or the most beautiful thing that I can, and working as hard as I can to get it there. And but there's never, it's not like there's this feeling of being done. That's one of my problems and why I probably need the deadlines, because I don't feel done necessarily. And, you know, I enjoy the process. I enjoy being in the middle of it.
I don't think anybody's ever done with anything, no matter what it is in life, whether it's doing the laundry or making an album. I mean, most musicians that I know, once an album is in the can, 6 months later, there's like, oh, if only.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So you just, at some point, it has to be put to bed, but the feeling of done, I think, doesn't exist in any way.
It doesn't for me, really. Overall, it doesn't. And so I do enjoy continuing to pursue it. I just don't know. I don't really worry about overthinking and overanalyzing. I think what happens is that I can notice 3 months out, 6 months out, 10 years out, that I didn't think about it in the right way, that I missed something, that I had an overview issue, and I was really super focused on this one thing, but there was a glaring something else that I couldn't see. And so I'm always working to achieve a better overview. But I'm not concerned about working too hard on something. That doesn't bother me at all.
You didn't get bogged down in the technology at all?
Not at all.
You found it freeing to be able to make the choices and then execute them yourself rather than looking for the words to express to somebody else.
Oh, 100%. Give me the controls.
Look out, Edgar Meyer has got the wheel.
Mm.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think there's an awful lot there of specifically about the
emphasis
new album
on the
as
awful.
Well as... No. Phil, we've got some, or Edgar's got some sweepers on his knee, as well as a banjo.
Here we go. Hi, this is Edgar Meyer, and you're listening to one of the most eclectic mixes. Oh. Hi, this is Edgar Meyer, and you're listening to one of the most eclectic mixes of music I've ever heard on the radio. Anything Goes with Lise Avery. You know this shit is hard.
No.
Okay, you're trying to build me up. Okay, go for it.
That's going to be the second sweeper we're going to do.
Okay.
You can do everyone, each one twice, and we can paste you two.
Okay. Hi. This is...
Hi.
Hi. Hi. Hi. This is Edgar Meyer, and you're tuned into Anything Goes with Lise Avery on this terrific radio station. Did I get by?
Okay. I think you did.
He likes it. Phil, see?
Okay. Hi, this is Edgar Meyer, and you're tuned into Anything Goes with Lise Avery on this terrific radio station. Hey, this is Edgar Meyer, and you're tuned into Anything Goes with Lise Avery on... Okay.
You need a 10.0 card.
Hey, this is Edgar Meyer, and you're tuned into Anything Goes with Lise Avery on WFDU-FM. That's a bitch. That...
So much easier when you're doing QXR and you have to sound sophisticated.
I'll give it one more shot. Hey, this is Edgar Meyer, and you're tuned in... Ugh. Hey. Ugh.
Oh, I like that one, Phil. Keep that.
Hey, this is Edgar Meyer, and you're tuned into Anything Goes with Lise Avery on WFDU-FM. And I have a cold.
Oh, was that so?
I'll Thank you. Hello, this is Edgar Meyer on Anything Goes with Lise Avery, and once a year this station asks for your help during their fund drive. A radio show that mixes the music up the way Lise does is not easy to find, so I hope you will give what you can to keep this great program going.
Very good. Excellent.
Isn't that hard, Edgar?
It's just all...
It's only dancers that can't talk. Musicians usually can.
It's not that easy. I find it perfectly challenging.